Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 98.
The pilgrims arriving in the real Western paradise. After everything they've been through, countless trials, the sources say they finally step into what's clearly marked as the true Western Buddhist land.
Yeah. And the descriptions, what do they tell us? It talks about dew-like rare flowers, jade-like grasses, ancient trees, cypresses and pines, a real sense of timeless purity.
And it's not just nature, the people too. Every family is good. Every home feeds monks. People are meditating, reciting scriptures.
And that's the key, isn't it? The contrast.
How so?
Well, think about everything they've faced. Demons, illusions, trickery, just constant struggle.
Right.
And now, the environment itself is peaceful. It breathes genuine devotion. It's like, it signals a shift. The battle isn't out there anymore.
It's becoming internal.
Exactly. An internal purification, getting them ready for the, you know, the final goal. The air itself feels different, sacred.
Okay, so they're soaking this in, and then this incredible building appears, described as basically towering into the sky.
Huge, yeah. Like its windows could swallow the universe. A real Urd. A spirit palace. Sounds amazing. But Tang Sanzan, the monk, he hesitates. That seems odd.
It does, initially. But Wukong, never one to mince words, he pushes back. The source quotes him. You insisted on bowing at fake places, fake Buddhas. You insisted on bowing at fake places, fake Buddhas.
Wow. That's direct. What's the significance there? Why call him out specifically on the fake places?
It's a really important point Wukong's making. It draws this sharp line between, let's say, just going through the motions, superficial piety, and truly recognizing holiness when you see it.
Like a test of discernment.
Precisely. And right then, they're greeted by this figure, the golden top immortal from the Jade True Temple, Heis.
Okay.
And he's quite a sight. Heis, E-G-E, wearing beautiful robes, holding a jade whisk, very ethereal.
A true immortal.
Right. But here's a detail that always gets me. He tells them he's been waiting for 10 years.
10 years? Seriously?
Yep. Apparently, Guanyin Bodhisattva told him they'd be there much earlier, so he says he was sort of fooled by her, but he waited patiently.
That's incredible dedication. Okay, so a long wait, a grand welcome, and then he offers them something crucial. A bath.
Yes, a ceremonial bath. And the language used is powerful. It says something like, merits complete, beads done, it's time to bathe.
Right.
Refine your true nature to match heavenly truth. A thousand hardships now cease. The vows and refuges are made new.
So it's washing away the journey's hardships.
And more. Siemens ended, truly entering Buddhist land. Symbolism, calamity's gone, thus seeing the true path. Wash off dust, cleanse grime, become unstained.
Wow. Return to the origin, restore the incorruptible body.
Exactly. So connecting that to the bigger picture, this isn't just a quick shower, obviously.
Clearly not.
It's deeply symbolic. A final, profound purification. It's about shedding all the dust of the mortal world, all the struggles, the grime of the journey.
Like hitting a spiritual reset button.
Perfectly put. It's about returning to their original true nature, being reborn, in a sense, ready for Buddhahood. The end of the demons, the start of the Buddhist land. It's a necessary step before the final approach.
Okay, so that bath is a major transformation point. And the next morning, you really see it. Tang Sanzang emerges totally changed. He's wearing his fancy cassock, the Tan hat, holding the staff.
Looking the part, finally.
Yeah, the immortal even comments, right? Yesterday ragged, today bright. Looking at him now, he's truly a Buddha's son.
A visible transformation.
So they're ready to go. And Wukong, you know, Mr. Shortcut, thinks he'll just zip him over on his cloud path.
Typical Wukong, fly straight there.
But the immortal stops him. He says, nope. You need to take the true path, the E.
Not the magical shortcut.
Right. He leads them through a back door of the temple and points directly at Ling Mountain, on which is shimmering with this amazing light.
Five-colored auspicious light, thousand layers of lucky mist. The goal is in sight.
Tang Sanzang is completely overwhelmed, wants to bow down right there.
Understandable emotion.
But Wukong holds him back. He reminds him of that saying, you am.
Literally, looking at the mountain, makes the horse walk backwards, or more like the destination looks closer than it is, or you can wear out your horse just looking at the mountain.
So basically, hold on, don't rush it, we're not quite there yet.
Yeah, and that distinction between Wukong's cloud path and the immortal's true path is fascinating.
What do you make of it?
Well, the cloud path is like a spiritual bypass, right? Quick, effortless, avoids the nitty-gritty.
Mm.
But the true path the immortal insists on, it's physical. It's deliberate, grounded. It suggests that even now, right at the very end, you can't just magically float there.
You still have to walk the steps.
Intentional effort is required. No shortcuts, even for Monkey King. And Wukong's reminder to Teng San Zhang, it's about patience. Even with enlightenment in view, you need the right timing for reverence, not just, you know, uncontrolled excitement.
Okay, so they take the true path, and then comes the final obstacle. And it's unexpected. A river, living water.
Yeah, described as rolling waves, rushing currents, pretty wide, 8 or 9, so maybe a few miles wide.
Mm.
And no boats, no ferries, no sign of people.
Just water. And across it, the Lingyan Ferry.
Which sounds grand, cloud-touching ferry.
Right, but it's not. It's a single log bridge.
Just one log spanning this wide, turbulent river. And it's described as Ai Wuyan, extremely slippery and really hard to cross.
My palms are sweating just thinking about it. Teng San Zhang is understandably terrified.
Absolutely frozen with fear.
And Pigsy. Oh, Pigsy just flat out refuses. He wants to use his magic, fly across using wind and fog. He actually says,
which is basically, brother, forget becoming a Buddha. I seriously cannot walk on that thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Such a human reaction, isn't it?
Yeah.
That feeling when the very last thing just seems impossible. Too much.
It really is. And it raises that core question. Why this? Why is the absolute final test something so physically simple in a way, but psychologically terrifying?
It's not a monster, not a demon.
No, it's a log.
Yeah.
Over water. It's a pure test of will, of trust. And Wukong's reaction is key. He insists,
you have to walk over this bridge to become a Buddha.
Yeah. Implying the way you cross is as important as getting across. You can't cheat. You have to face the fear, walk the narrow, slippery path yourself. No magic allowed.
So no flying over it with wind and fog.
Exactly. And Pigsy's reluctance, his wanting the easy way out. Then this really strange boat appears, a bottomless one. And what's fascinating is Sun Wukong's reaction. He seems to instantly know the boatman is Jian Fozu, you know, Namo Bao Trang Wong Wong Buddha. But Wukong, he keeps it quiet for a second, just yells for the boat. Why wouldn't he just say who it is? And this boat, what's that about?
Yeah, that's a great point about Wukong keeping quiet. It suggests he understands something massive is happening, something Teng San Zhang isn't quite ready to grasp intellectually yet. And this bottomless boat. Well, that's where things get really interesting, isn't it? It defies logic completely, which, you know, the path to enlightenment often does. It challenges how we think reality works. And the boatman himself, being a high-ranking Buddha, his presence right there, right then, it's crucial. He's the facilitator, the one enabling this final radical transformation for Teng San Zhang.
Right. It's like reality itself is bending. And the boatman gives this incredibly cryptic poem. It speaks of this boat existing since creation, unchanging, stable through chaos, guiding people forever. He says, "Ooh, Sarshasi." It's such a paradox. A boat with no bottom, but it's stable and guides everyone. How?
Exactly. And that paradox is the whole point. The poem's deeper meaning is, well, profound. It's not really a physical boat. It symbolizes eternal wisdom, the path of truth itself. Unchanging, steady, no matter the waves of life. And that line, the six dusts cleansed, returning to unity, that's key in Buddhism. It's about purifying the senses, right? Sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touch, thoughts. All the things that distract us. By letting go of those, you find unity, spiritual purity. So the boat, because it's bottomless, because it has no attachments, that's why it can carry everyone across the sea of suffering.
Ah, okay, so the lack of a bottom is actually its strength. But you know, Teng San Zhang, he's still hesitant. He just can't step onto this illogical thing. Mm. And what happens next, I mean, it really surprised me. It's maybe the most critical transformation moment. Wukong just shoves him, pushes Teng San Zhang right into the water.
Mm-hmm.
And then, even wilder, a dead body floats by, and Wukong, Baji, Wujing, even the boatmen, they all point and say, That's you. And they're cheering. Congratulations. What is going on?
That shove.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the absolute core of it. Your phrase, shock therapy, earlier, spot on. The dead body, it's not literal death, obviously. It's the symbolic shedding of his mortal self, his karma, everything tying him down. It's really a radical letting go. It suggests that true transcendence requires, well, the kind of symbolic death to your old self, your attachments, even your physical idea of yourself. It's this intense, almost violent spiritual rebirth. Shows that enlightenment isn't always gentle. You know, sometimes it needs that forceful break. And the cheering, that signifies success. He's done it. He's cleansed himself, ready for the final stage.
Wow. It's such a visceral image. And right after they cross, there's this poem that sort of seals it.
Okay.
Which basically means shed the mortal body, embrace the true spirit, journey done, he becomes Buddha, washing clean all the worldly dust. So he's truly changed then. What does shedding his body mean right now?
It means exactly what the poem says. He's shed his yasya, his physical, limited, mortal body, and he's embraced his true original spirit or nature. Those are all the karmic issues, the obstacles, the defilements from the whole journey. Now washed clean, this is the moment. He achieves Buddhahood. He transcends being human. He's not just a monk anymore. He's fundamentally transformed into a pure spiritual being.
Incredible. And Wukong, even though he did the shoving, he's so humble afterwards. When Tang Senzang thanks him, Wukong says something like, Atisha. Basically, no need for thanks. We helped each other. We benefited from your quest, got merit, reached enlightenment, and you needed our protection to shed your mortal form. It's about teamwork, isn't it?
It really is. And that's fascinating, that emphasis on mutual support. The journey to enlightenment, it's personal, yes, but here it's shown as a collective thing, too. Wukong points out, the disciples needed the master's mission for their own progress, their own path to Buddhahood or arhatship, and the master absolutely needed their protection, their support to make it through and shed that mortal coil. It really highlights how interconnected these paths can be. Maybe they gain just as much by helping him, you know?
That's a really interesting way to think about it. Okay, so profound cleansing done. And the landscape changes completely. They finally start climbing Spirit Mountain towards Lion Monastery, Osu. And the description, it's breathtaking. Reaching the sky, rooted in Sumeru. Clever peaks, strange rocks. It's full of beautiful herbs and fragrant orchids. You've got immortal apes picking fruit, white cranes on pines, even phoenixes and blue luan birds.
Mm.
And the monastery, golden tiles, palaces and treasure towers. It sounds like paradise, especially compared to where they've been.
Oh, absolutely. And that imagery, it's not just pretty description, it's deeply symbolic. This isn't just any mountain. It's a pure land, a realm of enlightenment, a total contrast to the evil places they battled through. Lines like, a place so beautiful it seems separate from heaven, where red dust doesn't reach and all karmic ties are exhausted. It signifies profound peace, permanence. It's like the place itself reflects their purified state.
And getting there isn't casual either. It's a very formal welcome at Lion Monastery. The news of their arrival goes up this chain of command, right? From the Vajra guardians at the gate, through more gates, all the way to Sakyamuni Buddha himself. And Tang Sanzang introduces himself as Wanzang, his given name. It feels very solemn.
It does. And that whole elaborate process, it just underscores the incredible importance, the sanctity of the place. And it shows the immense respect for those who've actually completed this monumental spiritual journey. It's not just walking in. It's an honored ascension. A public recognition. It's like the cosmos itself is acknowledging their achievement.
And the Buddha's reaction, pure joy. He calls this huge assembly to greet them. Let's see. 8 bodhisattvas, 4 Vajra guardians, 500 arhats, 3,000 jieti, 11 great stars, 18 gurung. They're all lined up. Tang Zen, Wukong, Wunang, Wujing. They enter respectfully. I mean, that's quite the welcome party. What does that sheer scale tell us?
That's a really good question. The size of that assembly, it signifies the universal importance of what they've done. It shows that their perseverance, their attainment of truth, it resonates on a cosmic scale. It's not just about their personal salvation. It's a victory for the Dharma, celebrated throughout all spiritual realms. It really hammers home the value of their achievement.
And to kind of wrap up the whole journey, there's this final, really poignant poem about Tang Senzang's quest. It says, Husio, and it goes on to describe the whole journey. You know, morning climbs in mist, evening rest on stones, carrying his staff through rivers and cliffs, always seeking the right fruit. And the final line, Husio, only today did he get to see the Tathagata. They get to the Great Leyan Temple and they just, you know, prostrate themselves before Buddha, total reverence. And Tang Sanzang very humbly hands over to that's his official passport from the emperor, basically saying, mission accomplished. You can almost feel the relief, can't you, after 14 years.
Oh, absolutely. It's a huge moment. But what gets really interesting, like immediately, is Buddha's assessment. His take on the Dua, that's Tang China, is, well, frankly, it's pretty startling. He doesn't just pat them on the back. Nope. He launches into this quite blunt list of everything wrong with the people back home. Things like much greed, much killing, much lust, much deceit, you know, the whole list, much cheating, much fraud. And he keeps going. He says they don't follow Buddhist teachings. They don't aim for good deeds. They don't respect the three lights.
The sun, moon, stars.
Exactly. And they don't value the five grains. It's this really thorough and honestly damning critique. It suggests their society is just fundamentally off track spiritually and morally.
Wow. Yeah, that is unflinching. Right when they arrive after this incredibly sacred journey, does that mean the trip wasn't just about getting scriptures back, but maybe about, I don't know, fixing the people themselves?
I think that's exactly it. It sets the stage, doesn't it? The journey was maybe just step one. Buddha's basically saying the real work starts now, tackling these deep-seated problems. He even spells out the consequences, warns that their actions lead to the calamities of hell, like forever falling into the netherworld.
Yeah.
He talks about awful suffering, pounding, grinding, milling, even being reborn as animals. And for some, it's Avicii hell, which is just, you know, endless suffering. It's grim. Really underlines why they needed those scriptures.
Yeah.
And get this, he's not done. He points out that even Confucius's teachings, you know, benevolence, righteousness, all that.
Uh-huh.
And the emperor's laws, even with harsh punishments like, well, exile, strangulation, decapitation.
Yikes.
Even that isn't enough. Not enough to handle what Buddha calls the ignorant and unrestrained folks. People just too stuck in their ways.
So the only answer then is Buddha's solution, the Dhyā, the Tripitaka scriptures. He says point blank, they can transcend suffering and resolve calamities. So it's not just wisdom. It's like a lifeline.
Precisely. A lifeline. And it's crucial how he describes how comprehensive these scriptures are. He breaks down the Tripitaka. There's the Oro and Huo, which talks about heaven.
Uh-huh.
Then Slun, which talks about earth. Jing, which saves ghosts. So it covers everything. Heaven, earth, the afterlife. A complete guide. And the sheer size. He says it's 35 parts, over 15,000 volumes. 15,000. And they cover literally everything. Astronomy, geography, people, birds, beasts, flowers, trees, utensils, human affairs across the world. Nothing left out. It's like the ultimate encyclopedia of existence.
But okay, even with this incredible solution, this massive library of wisdom, Buddha adds a catch, doesn't he? A warning about the Easterners. He calls them foolish and stubborn, says they slander true words and just don't understand the deeper Buddhist teachings. That feels like, well, like he's setting up the next big challenge for them, right? Getting people to actually listen.
Oh, absolutely. It's a huge piece of foreshadowing. Delivering the texts is one thing. Getting them accepted. Whole different ballgame. So after this really heavy sermon, Ananda and Kasyapa, they follow Buddha's orders and take the pilgrims to this, you know, a treasure pavilion for a meal. Kind of a heavenly reward, I guess.
And what a meal, it sounds like. Immortal foods, immortal delicacies, immortal tea, immortal fruits. 100 flavors. The text specifically says it was unlike the mortal world. Can you imagine after years of roughing it on the road?
Yeah, and it's not just tasty, it's transformative. Especially for Pigsy and Sandy, the book calls it food that sheds the mortal coil and changes bones. Basically a spiritual upgrade.
Wow.
It gives them true longevity. So this isn't just dinner, it's like a divine power-up. Real physical and spiritual nourishment right at the end.
Okay, so after that amazing meal, they finally go into the treasure pavilion itself, where the scriptures are kept, and the description is just as grand. Radiant glow, auspicious aura, colorful mist, auspicious clouds. Sounds incredible. And inside, everything's perfectly organized. Scriptures with red labels, neatly inscribed with scripture names.
And the list of titles is, well, immense. Just like Buddha said, you've got the Nirvana Sutra, 748 volumes.
Just that one?
Yep. The Yadamsaka Sutra, 500 volumes. The Mahaprajnaparamita Sutra, over 900 volumes. The Diamond Sutra, 100 volumes, Lotus Sutra, another 100. And then some huge ones, like the Miscellaneous Sutras of the Buddha Land at nearly 2,000 volumes.
What a grief.
And the Prestige of the Jewel Sutra, over 1,200. It's not just scrolls. It's, like you said, a whole library. The scale is just staggering.
Right. So they've had the sermon, the mind-blowing feast. They're standing in this divine library. You'd think, okay, smooth sailing now. Hand over the wisdom. But then bam, something totally unexpected. Ananda and Kasyapa, the guys leading them, they basically ask for a tip. They say, holy monk, you came all the way from the East. What gifts did you bring us? Give them here and we'll give you the scriptures.
Yeah, it means like gifts, payment, maybe even a bribe, depending how you read it. It's a total shocker, isn't it? After this epic spiritual quest. And Sanzang, bless him, he's just honest. He says, sorry, I haven't prepared any, you know, long journey. Wasn't really thinking about bringing souvenirs for the monks at the end. He's got nothing.
And their reaction, the venerables just say, good, good, good. Transmit scriptures empty-handed. Future generations will starve. Like, completely cynical. Talk about an aha moment. The highest spiritual peak. And suddenly it's transactional. Sacred meets mercenary. It just throws this very human, very earthly element into the mix.
It really does. And Monkey King naturally just blows his top. He's immediately like, Master, forget this. Let's go straight to Buddha. Tell him to give us the scriptures himself. Yeah. He sees it as totally unfair, ready to just bypass these guys.
Yeah.
Classic Monkey King, right? Impulsive, wants justice now.
Yeah, but then Pigsy and Sandy step in. They're often the sensible ones in these moments, aren't they? They manage to calm Monkey down, talk him out of, you know, causing a scene right there in front of everyone.
Right.
They restrained their patience and calmed Monkey King. So the transaction goes ahead, awkward as it is.
So yeah, despite Monkey's grumbling, they start collecting the scriptures. And the text makes it sound like real work. Volume by volume, packed into bags, mm-hmm. loaded onto the horse, and two more loads tied up for Pigsy and Sandy to carry.
Huh.
It really drives home that this enlightenment isn't just an idea, it's heavy. It's thousands of physical volumes they now have to haul back.
And with that massive tangible burden, they finally leave. They bow to Buddha, all the other Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, everyone there. The spiritual journey ends, and the very physical journey home begins.
They've got their hands on the precious scriptures, loaded them onto the horse.
Big relief, you'd think.
Totally. They're ready for the long journey home, anticipation buzzing.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, this final step takes a really unexpected turn because high above, in the monastery, Burning Lamp Ancient Buddha is listening in.
And what's truly remarkable here is that Burning Lamp Ancient Buddha already knows what's happened. He's completely aware that Ananda and Kasyapa, the ones who handed over the scriptures,
yeah.
gave Tang Sanzang blank scrolls. And his reaction,
yeah.
he laughs.
He laughs. Not anger or like disappointment.
No, he just finds it amusing. He actually chuckles that Eastern land monks are foolish and wouldn't recognize unlettered scriptures. It's this knowing amusement, almost like a deliberate calculation is unfolding.
He immediately commands white-browed venerable, who's this powerful attendant,
mm-hmm.
to swoop down and snatch these blank scriptures away, basically forcing Tang Sanzang and his crew to turn around and come back.
Right. And white-browed venerable carries this out with just impressive, overwhelming power. The text gives this really vivid picture of the wind he conjures up.
Oh, yeah.
It says, fish and dragons lost their dens, rivers and seas reversed their waves, pine branches broke, even delicate pike flowers floated away.
Wow. So serious power.
Oh, absolutely. It's not just a breeze. It's a gale so mighty it apparently sent bell sounds 3,000 lies away. That's roughly 1,000 miles.
1,000 miles.
Oh, yeah.
Good grief.
Yeah, it gives you a sense of the scale, right? It even made scripture rhythms lightly fly 10,000 ravines high. This was no ordinary gust. It was this deliberate, powerful force of nature designed to make sure those scriptures were lost. To make a point.
So imagine Tang Sanzang riding along and he feels this fragrant wind rolling in. He probably thinks, oh, this is nice, a good omen.
A blessing, maybe.
Exactly. But he's totally caught off guard. Suddenly, boom, a hand descends from the sky, snatches the scriptures right off the horse.
Just gone.
It's not just losing stuff. It feels like a profound spiritual challenge, right? Designed to test their understanding. Tang Sanzang is, understandably, beside himself, beating his chest, wailing.
Mm-hmm.
Pigsy is frantically trying to chase it, rolling on the ground. Mm-hmm. Sandy's being steadfast, guarding everything else. And Monkey.
Ah, Monkey. Quick as ever.
Like lightning. He just shoots off in pursuit like a bullet.
But white-browed venerable is cunning, you know? He sees Monkey closing in super fast, probably realizes he might get whacked by that staff.
Good point, yeah.
So to force Monkey to back off, he deliberately tears open the scripture package and just scatters the blank pages into the wind.
Oh, smart move.
Masterstroke, really. It works perfectly. Monkey sees these precious pages, even though they're blank scattering everywhere. He has to abandon the chase and focus on gathering them up instead.
So the moment of truth arrives. The team frantically gathers up all these scattered pages. And then the horror dawns.
Yeah.
As they unroll scroll after scroll, every single one is completely blank. Snow White, the text says, without a single mark of character.
Oof. Imagine that feeling.
Right. The sheer gut punch after all that effort, all those years. Tanguy Sensei's despair is just palpable. He collapses, heartbroken, lamenting their misfortune, crying out about the crime of deceiving the emperor.
Must have made them question everything, all that sacrifice for nothing.
Exactly. Which brings up the big question. Who would do such a thing? And what's interesting here is Monkey's reaction.
His deduction, yeah. Sharp.
Instantly sharp. He immediately suspects Ananda and Kasyapa, the two monks who handed them the scrolls in the first place.
Right. He figures it wasn't random.
No. He believes they intentionally gave them blank books because they didn't receive personal favors.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, a bribe.
Mm-hmm. A little something extra.
Right. And this quick insight, connecting the dots, it leads them to decide, okay, we're going back.
Straight back to Lion Monastery to confront the Buddha himself.
Yeah. So picture this dramatic return. Instead of, you know, celebrating their success, they're marching back and they are furious.
Not happy campers?
Definitely not. And the monks of the gates, they greet them with these knowing smiles, asking, Holy monk, are you here to exchange scriptures?
Oh, they knew.
Seems like it. And Monkey, well, he doesn't hold back. He storms right into Buddha's presence, loudly accusing Ananda and Kasyapa of corruption.
Mm-hmm.
Says they extorted money, cheated them, gave them blank scrolls. And Buddha's reaction to all this shouting.
Well, this is where it gets really intriguing, I think. Buddha doesn't deny it. He doesn't get angry or defensive. He simply laughs.
Laughs again.
Yeah. And calmly admits he already knows about the bribe. He basically says, you don't have to shout. I already know about them asking you for personal favors.
Wow. Okay, that challenges your immediate expectation of a divine response, doesn't it?
It really does.
So Buddha is admitting to a bribe.
Yeah.
And even seems to be justifying it. That feels like a pretty radical idea when we're talking about sacred knowledge.
It does seem that way at first glance.
If wisdom comes with a price tag, is Buddha challenging our whole notion of enlightenment here?
Mm-hmm.
What exactly is he trying to teach Tang San Zhang by demanding or at least condoning this personal favor?
Precisely. And Buddha then explains his reasoning. He says something like, scriptures cannot be easily transmitted, nor can they be obtained empty-handed.
Right.
And he gives this example from the past. Some monks recited scriptures for an elder Zhao back in the mortal world. Their chanting secured safety for the living, salvation for the dead. Pretty powerful stuff.
Sounds valuable.
Extremely valuable. Yet they only received 3 du and 3 sheng of rice grain gold, which apparently was a ridiculously small amount. Almost insulting.
Like not even covering expenses.
Barely. Buddha felt it was too cheap. He actually laments that it left nothing for future generations, that such profound wisdom was basically given away for pennies.
Ah, okay. I see where this is going.
And this is where he connects it right back to Tang San Zhang. Buddha says, you now come empty-handed, so you were given blank books. But then comes the twist.
The twist.
He calls the blank books unlettered true scriptures. And he says they are actually good.
Unlettered true scriptures. So the blank ones were the real deal, in a way.
In a sense, yes. A higher form, perhaps.
Yep.
Buddha seems to imply that the people in the Eastern land are, let's say, foolish and unenlightened. They need scriptures with actual words because they aren't ready for that profound wordless truth.
The truth that can't just be bought or handed over easily?
Exactly. True enlightenment isn't always spelled out. Sometimes the deepest truths are absorbed through the effort, through the trial, through the price paid, whether that price is actual money or maybe just the immense effort of the journey itself.
So the blank scriptures were a test. A lesson, a higher truth they just weren't equipped for yet.
That seems to be the implication, yeah. It was a necessary step in their understanding.
Okay. And so finally, the resolution. After delivering this pretty profound explanation,
mm-hmm.
Buddha orders Ananda and Kasyapa to provide the actual scriptures, the ones with words, making sure Tang San Zhang's monumental mission is truly fulfilled, at least in the way the emperor expected.
Right. The physical journey and the spiritual one kind of reaches its conclusion there. They get the written texts they came for. The two venerables there, Anuo and Jiyananda and Kasyapa, they're kind of the librarians, the keepers of the scrolls.
Mm-hmm. Important figures.
They ask Tang San Zhang again for human affairs.
Which is basically code for.
A gift. A payment.
Tang San Zhang is genuinely broke. Mm. I mean, 14 years on the road, relying on alms.
Mm-hmm.
He has nothing.
Right. Worn out.
Totally. So his only possession of any real value is that purple gold begging bowl.
Oh, the one the emperor gave him.
Exactly. Not just any bowl. It was a personal gift from the Tang Emperor, specifically for collecting alms. So he offers that. He's quite humble about it, apologizes for being poor.
Promises the Emperor will reward them later. Just give us the real scriptures this time, the ones with text.
Yeah, you can feel his anxiety there. And it really highlights this tension, doesn't it? The material world just lingering.
Okay.
Even right there at the gates of heaven, so to speak.
But the reaction, that's maybe even more mind-blowing, the other celestial beings who are around.
The temple guardians, the cooks, the strong men.
Yeah, all of them. They start openly laughing at Anuo and Jiayue, mocking them.
The text is quite specific, isn't it? Pinching faces, flicking fingers.
Twisting lips, all saying shameless. Shameless, asking the scripture seeker for payment. So after that whole awkward payment situation.
Where they do take the bowl, despite the mockery.
Right. They still keep the bowl. Anyway, Tang Senzang, he's clearly learned his lesson from before. He's not taking any chances this time.
Understandably.
He got blank scrolls. Imagine the heartbreak.
Devastating. So this time he immediately tells his disciples, Sun Wukong, Zubaji, Shaowujing, look carefully. Check every single one, make sure it's not like last time.
He needs that confirmation. He needs to see the words.
And thankfully, this is the moment of relief. For everyone involved, including us reading it, the disciples, they go through them meticulously, scroll by scroll, and they confirm. They all have text. Yuzi, Jimmy, they're the real deal this time.
Oh, thank goodness. You can just feel the tension break there.
Absolutely. Their quest wasn't in vain, and the scale of what they've got, it's immense.
How many exactly?
The text gives a precise number. 5,048 scrolls, 5,048.
Wow.
That's a full Tripitaka, Izan Zishu.
5,000 scrolls. That's, I mean, just physically, think about that. How do they even carry it all?
Right. It's not just an abstract concept anymore. It's heavy. The text paints a picture. Ooh. Must go on the horse.
White dragon horse, yeah.
Then Zubaji, you know, he's the strong one. He carries another big bundle himself.
Okay.
Shaowujing handles his own luggage, as always. Sun Wukong leads the horse.
Mm-hmm.
And Tang Senzang himself, he just adjusts his hat, his robe, holds his staff, ready to go.
It really gives you a sense of the like the physical weight of all that spiritual knowledge they're bringing back. It's tangible. A burden, but also this incredible treasure.
Exactly. A profound responsibility. So scripture's secured, verified, loaded up. Now they go back to the Buddha. Tathagata.
Must have been feeling pretty good by this point. Joyful, the text says.
Oh, absolutely. And this isn't just a quick thanks and goodbye. The Buddha calls for this huge, grand assembly.
Right, you mentioned that. Who turns up?
Everyone, basically.
Yeah.
He has the arhats, Jianglong and Fuhu, sound the cloud chimes.
Mm-hmm.
And the guest list is enormous. 3,000 Buddhas, 3,000 Jiti, 8 Vajras, 4 Bodhisattvas.
Wow.
500 arhats, 800 monks, lay followers, beings from all the different heavens and holy places. It's like the ultimate celestial summit.
The light, the music.
Heavenly sounds, auspicious light, everyone in their proper place, respectful. For the pilgrims, after 14 years of hardship, this must feel like validation on a cosmic scale.
The ultimate acknowledgement. Relief mixed with awe, I imagine.
Definitely. And then, once everyone's settled, the Buddha asks Anuo and Jiayue, the ones who asked for the bowl.
Uh-huh.
He asks them to report on the scriptures they handed over.
So like an official inventory check?
Pretty much. To confirm the number again, 5,048 scrolls. And then they list out the categories, 35 specific categories.
35? Wow.
Yeah, it's incredibly detailed. They mention big ones like the Nirvana Sutra, that's 400 scrolls. The Prajnaparamita Sutra, the Perfection of Wisdom, that's 600 scrolls.
Huge texts.
And then, interestingly, they also mention the Vajra Sutra, the Diamond Sutra, just one single scroll.
Just one, but obviously very important.
Vitally important. It shows the meticulous nature of this collection. It's not just bulk. It's specific, organized, comprehensive library.
Okay, so the inventory's done. Everyone knows what's been handed over. What does the Buddha say to Tang Senzang then? This must be the big moment.
It is. The Buddha addresses Tang Senzang directly and emphasizes the immeasurable merit of these scriptures, their unbelievable value.
More than just religious texts, right?
Much more. He calls them a mirror. For Buddhism itself, yes, but also, get this, the source of the three teachings.
Wait, three teachings? You mean Buddhism, Taoism, and Confucianism?
That's what he says. He positions these Buddhist scriptures as foundational to the entire spiritual and philosophical framework of China, of the East. It's a massive statement about their importance.
That is huge. And does he give instructions, like how to handle them?
Oh, yes. Very strict guidelines for when they get back to your world, the southern continent, They're not to be treated lightly at all. You have to bathe and fast before you even open them to read.
Yeah.
They must be treasured, cherished.
So it's not just about having the knowledge, it's about showing reverence for it.
Precisely. The Buddha is really stressing that point. True wisdom demands respect, requires active engagement, not just passive consumption. Then he hints at what's really inside them. He says, these scriptures contain, and I'm quoting loosely here, the mysteries of becoming immortal and enlightened.
Whoa.
And miraculous methods to invent myriad transformations. Basically, the secrets to transcendence and immense power.
Okay, so they have the scriptures, they have the instructions. Mission accomplished, right? Time to head home.
Almost. There's one final, slightly bizarre, last-minute detail. A bit of celestial admin.
Admin.
Seems like it. Just after the scriptures were all sorted, Guanyin, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, who sort of oversaw the whole quest.
Uh-huh. Avalokiteshvara.
Right. She approaches the Buddha, and she has this, like, calculation. She points out the mission took 14 years.
Which we knew.
Which equals 5,040 days.
Okay.
But she says the proper Tripitaka count, the specific sacred number associated with the scriptures, requires, well, it requires 5,048 days to be complete.
Wait. So they're short by how much?
8 days. They're 8 days short of fulfilling this sort of numerological requirement for her golden decree, her official record of the mission. Isn't it just, it's like the cosmic ledger needs to be balanced perfectly.
Hmm.
So Guanyin requests something pretty extraordinary.
What?
She asks that the pilgrims be sent back east to Chang'an to deliver the scriptures and then brought immediately back west, all within those 8 days.
Fly them there and back in 8 days, just to make the numbers match up.
Exactly, to fulfill the Tripitaka count and let her finalize her report, basically.
Wow, and does the Buddha agree?
Instantly, no hesitation. He commands the 8 great Vajras, these powerful guardian deities, to use their divine speed and power.
To do what?
To fly Tang Sanzang and the others, scriptures and all, back to the Chang capital, let them drop off the texts, and then zip them straight back to the west, all inside that 8-day window.
The ultimate express delivery service.
You could say that. And the text notes that the group suddenly feels light-bodied, free from their earthly forms, as they ascend onto the clouds with the Vajras.
Ah, so it's not just travel. It's like their transformation is complete, their ascension is happening right then, as the mission technically concludes.
Precisely. It signifies they've reached that higher state, their task finally and numerically perfectly done.